From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we speak with Milwaukee's former Director of Disease Control and Environmental Health about how the city is and should be reacting to the coronavirus. Then gardening expert Melinda Myers gives us her tips for starting seeds indoors and what plants to start right now.
Right now it's a good time to start broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, those things that like it cool, because they'll be ready to plant outside end of April. They'll be a good size, not too big.
And we visit a monastery near Manitowoc where a former gourmet chef now feeds pilgrims instead of New York's rich and famous.
You're supposed to be living a poor life so that the money that we save from changing our diet can then be given as alms to the poor. They all work together.
Plus, a lesson about kindness from contributor Arno Michaelis. Lake Effect is next, but first this news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Each day we see the rise of confirmed COVID-19 cases as places across the globe work to treat and respond to the novel coronavirus pandemic. And it's not just global cities that are at risk for things like SARS, H1N1, or even COVID-19, but also all of the secondary cities and urban hubs such as Milwaukee. We've seen mandates and efforts passed both on the federal and state level, but cities also play a large part in preparing for, mitigating, and adapting to pandemics. Paul Biedritsky is the former Director of Disease Control and Environmental Health for the City of Milwaukee. His work with the city included preparing for and responding to everything from Cryptosporidium to H1N1. And while no two viruses are the same, Biedritsky says that existing action plans for pandemics can help establish protocols to help ensure the health of city populations. He joined me by phone as we all practice social distancing, and he starts with his reaction to the federal government's response to coronavirus.
Well, I think the federal government has really, in the last few days, stepped up their game with the declaration of a national emergency and really a lot of messaging now flowing from at least the federal health officials on how to, again, respond to the pandemic. I think it's improved, but I do think we are out of the gate a little late, perhaps by a couple of weeks, since the first case was detected on the West Coast almost a month ago.
Do you feel there's one country or other place in particular that has been a good example on trying to follow or stay ahead of the curve? You mentioned we're a few weeks behind.
Yeah, well, I think China has really improved, again, their response efforts in ways that have curbed the spread of disease significantly. I know other countries, Japan, South Korea, Italy, have large outbreaks. I think there have been some successes, but I think many of these countries are struggling to keep up with the growing number of cases and containing the spread of infection in their communities.
You have previously worked on other viruses and pandemics, such as the H1N1 response. But do you feel like resources put into planning for these, whether it's H1N1 or other past ones, you know, just kind of get filed away or forgotten? Do you feel like people are starting from scratch to respond to every new virus? Not that all viruses are the same by any means, but that some of these lessons can be transferred over and preparedness always in place.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we put a lot of resources, by we, I mean the federal government, state and local government, in particular public health agencies, in preparing for pandemic influenza episodes going way back to 2005 when H5N1 was on our radar, and of course, followed by the 2009 H1N1 swine flu pandemic. I think there were lots of resources, a lot of planning, a lot of preparedness, partnerships formed in the community, both vertically and horizontally, to prepare for these events. And I do think some of that has been lost over time. I think there has been a certain level of complacency that has set in, not only with government agencies, but with the public in general.
How does that make you feel? Because you put a lot of work and effort into helping people prepare for and respond.
Yeah, I am a little discouraged. Again, there was a lot of time and resources, not only by myself and by the Milwaukee Health Department, by many, many other government agencies and community partners in preparing for a pandemic and exercising those plans and then refining them, along with lessons learned even from the H1N1 pandemic, which was far milder than we anticipated, but nevertheless had a tremendous impact on economic and social activity within communities.
So what is currently known about the epidemiology of COVID-19 that people are trying to respond to right now?
Yeah, so there's not a full understanding of the transmissibility, the vulnerability profile, or the virulence of this new microbe. There's also limited information on environmental surfaces and cleaning of those surfaces that may be critical to the transmission of virus in communities. We do know that this is a virus that is easily spread, as easily as flu, if not more, within communities. So person-to-person transmission and most likely environmental surface transmission is occurring even as we speak. We know that the most vulnerable right now at this phase in the pandemic appears to be older individuals. It tends to skew older, and those individuals with what we refer to as comorbidities or underlying medical conditions seem to be most at risk. But there are a smattering of younger individuals with no underlying health conditions that are also equally vulnerable. The transmissibility, again, is very, very critical. We're at that phase in the pandemic where the number of cases will grow exponentially over the coming weeks as we reach the peak of what we refer to as the epidemic curve. So it's incredibly important to aggressively implement and pursue social distancing within a community to really lessen or reduce the steepness of that curve and buy us some time, as well as preserve healthcare capacity within our communities.
We here locally, other people around the country, the world, they can see where things are the worst. But as Milwaukee and Wisconsin learn more, have more confirmed cases, what are their current actions right now? And do you think there's anything missing from current actions being taken?
Well, I think there's a number of things that probably are in place, but I'm not sure have been fully realized. For example, again, the monitoring and assurance of hospital and acute care capacity, as well as practice of good infection control, is paramount, again, at this point in the epidemic, as well as assuring first responder safety and health. And by that, I mean the EMTs or the ED clinicians and staff that are on the front line to see potential coronavirus infections. I think testing capacity also is still very limited, especially for those with no insurance or those that are underinsured, as well as defining who needs to get tested immediately versus those that can wait. I'm not sure that there has been really hotlines or resources set up in the community for social service referrals for people that might be homebound, for example, or those that require mental health resources or services, which are incredibly important during these types of events. And then I haven't heard a lot about homeless and transient population care within our community. And I think that's, again, a very important piece that needs to be addressed sooner than later as we move through this pandemic curve.
Right. And typically, do city officials meet with businesses and nonprofit stakeholders to discuss implementation to make sure that, there's a continuation of business operations? I mean, many businesses are closing and shutting down as a precaution. But what is the city of Milwaukee's role in checking in with vital organizations throughout the city?
Well, I think that's really, really an important part. Part of pandemic flu planning when I was at the city of Milwaukee included really attention to business continuity of operations that involve the whole of community. You mentioned government, nonprofits, and private sector, which certainly will be impacted. So I would think that there would be, again, a sharing of information and what we call situational awareness regarding the pandemic as it progresses through its various phases to ensure that there was good continuity of operations within the community, again, to build what we refer to as resiliency, both economic and social resiliency within a community. That goes a long way in terms of expediting recovery, because eventually the pandemic will be over and recovery operations are much smoother when you have, again, good continuity of operations through various phases of a pandemic.
In your opinion, what does economic and social resiliency look like in these stages? Because right now, as we are talking, people are seeing the measures being taken, working from home, or perhaps not even be able to work at all. So what is your wider perspective on that?
Yeah, so I think this means, again, good information sharing across all sectors of the community regarding the epidemiology of disease, the effectiveness of social distancing measures that are being recommended, and the sharing of resources. The private sector in particular has many resources that can be brought to bear in assuring community continuity of operations and resiliency to ensure an effective response. And by that, I mean where we minimize the impact on the health of the population, which of course is tied to, again, the economic and social resiliency of a community.
Right. There's also the added layer of healthcare capacity. Where does the city of Milwaukee lie in this respect?
So I don't have intimate knowledge of, again, not working for the city of Milwaukee or being employed by the city of Milwaukee. I don't have intimate knowledge, again, on healthcare capacity or surge demand on healthcare capacity right now. But what I'm hearing, just looking at the nationwide news and information available, that there is a real concern about surge capacity exploding in the coming weeks, where hospital beds, ventilators, and key medical support and treatment may not be available for those most in need. I think that is problematic. So looking at new standards of care and triaging are likely going to be very, very important for hospitals and acute care facilities in the coming weeks.
And is it standard that city government and officials are in communication with both public and private healthcare administrators in making sure that things are on the same page when it comes to diagnostic reporting, testing, and treatment recommendations? You know, how does the city act as a facilitator in this regard?
So that's a great point also. So again, when I was employed by the City of Milwaukee Health Department, we had ways of communicating electronically and conducting surveillance, as well as sending messaging to all healthcare providers within the community regarding diagnostics, clinical testing, treatment, and supportive care, as well as infection control within those settings. And that was pretty seamless, again, when I worked for the Milwaukee Health Department. I assume those systems are still in place, if not improved.
Gotcha. In addition to that, does the city have, in addition to being in communication with healthcare administrators, but for the rest of city operations, you know, there's waste, water, street repair, along with utilities that need to be maintained during a period of labor shortage, especially if people are made and choosing to be in their homes due to sickness or needing care. So does the city have a strategy in place that is automatic and, you know, making some adjustments, but typically in a situation like this that you plan for in a pandemic, what kind of strategy does the city have for its operations?
So continuity of government operations are part of that whole of community continuity of operations, and critical infrastructure such as water distribution, wastewater treatment, the electrical grid, the fiber grid, are all considered critical infrastructure that planning addresses, at least did address in the pandemic planning that I was involved, and really revolves around identifying essential services and essential personnel, and then prioritizing that in terms of ensuring operations are not interrupted for any significant time within a community. So I would like to think, again, those continuity of government operation plans are in place, if not activated. Maybe they're partially activated. They should be fully activated, given, again, the phase of the pandemic we are currently in.
So when you were meeting with businesses as a part of pandemic planning, how do local big businesses, you know, we've heard about small businesses closing, but there's still a lot of big corporations and businesses here that need to have a strategy in place. So what does that typically look like for big businesses in Milwaukee, such as Northwestern Mutual or U.S. Bank or a number of many large businesses that have hundreds of employees?
Yeah, so when I was, again, Director of Disease Control and Environmental Health for the City of Milwaukee, I had the opportunity to work with many large employers within the city to help them prepare and, more importantly, calibrate their planning in coordination with city and state pandemic plans. And one point I underscored over and over was that, you know, our community were their employees and their employees were our community. So we were working for, you know, mutual interests. There were co-benefits for us working together. And a lot of the planning dealt with sharing information, especially around the epidemiology of diseases as it emerged, sharing that information very quickly so they could, again, react accordingly. A lot of the planning involved exploring telecommuting options, for example, for their employees, cross-training employees that are in essential roles within their agency or organization, exploring the opportunity to hold virtual meetings or teleconferences instead of sending people on business travel, and then how to maintain facilities. There was strong interest by many employers on how to appropriately clean and maintain facilities over the duration of a pandemic. So all of these were the type of issues, and again, very well placed on in terms of concern on their part, because this is what is required to ensure assure continuity of operations for many of these organizations.
So on one last note for people to remember, what are your top recommendations for us on a personal level and then a work level and then citywide when it comes to Milwaukee at this time?
First and foremost is to take social distancing recommendations by local public health very seriously. To stay at home if you are symptomatic with illness or you have a known or confirmed exposure to disease. Certainly call your healthcare provider first. Do not go to the emergency departments, which are likely be overwhelmed. Avoiding non-essential gatherings and avoiding mass transit spaces like airports, bus terminals, and train stations. Avoid visiting high-risk elderly individuals in long-term care facilities or nursing homes. But it's important to check in on your neighbors, the elderly that are isolated during this time. There's ways of checking up on them that are incredibly important. Of course, practice good hygiene, good cough etiquette, good hand hygiene. This is the time to condition yourself to really routinely practice hygiene every single day. And then stay informed. Stay informed. The CDC, the State of Wisconsin Division of Public Health, and the Milwaukee Health Department all have websites that are constantly being updated regarding the spread of coronavirus within the community.
Paul Biadutsky, thank you very much.
Thank you, Audrey.
Paul Biadutsky is the former Director of Disease Control and Environmental Health for the City of Milwaukee. He joined me by phone, and you can find more of our coverage of the coronavirus at WUWM.com. Coming up next, gardening expert Melinda Myers gives us her tips for starting seeds. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Although social distancing has many of us stuck at home, there are still opportunities to reconnect with nature. Health professionals still suggest getting fresh air and taking walks, and even adding some greenery to your life. Melinda Myers is an expert on all things gardening, and although March is a bit early to start digging in the garden, there are still some ways to work out your green thumb. Myers chats with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about starting seeds and winter sowing.
I've already heard from people who really want to start digging in their garden, even though it's only March. Let's start here. Should people be thinking about digging directly into that garden right now, today?
You know, there are some people that plant their peas on St. Patrick's Day, even if they have to shovel the snow. I saw a pretty fun video where this woman was in Vermont, and she shoveled 3 feet of snow off her garden. She took a high heel to make an indentation. The tube from a roll of wrapping paper rolled her pea seeds down each hole and planted them. I'm not sure I'm ready to do that, but there's a lot we can can do inside. And as the snow recedes, grab that leaf rake and just lightly fluff up your lawn to help it dry out quicker and reduce the risk of snow mold forming. Kind of see what's going on outside. Clean up, pick up, that kind of thing. Make some notes where you're going to have to reseed the lawn because of voles and prune off any broken or dead branches. But otherwise, it's a good time to start some things indoors.
Yeah, so if you're hoping to start seed indoors, what should you start growing right now in March?
You know, always check the seed packet because it'll tell you start this X number of weeks before the last spring frost. And, you know, even though you look at the average, I usually say Memorial Day is when we start planting out tomatoes and peppers. The middle of May is when we can do beans and corn. So kind of keep those dates in mind as you're counting back. So right now it's a good time to start broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, those things that like it cool, because they'll be ready to plant outside end of April. They'll be a good size, not too big. Wait on those tomatoes and peppers until early April. As much as we want to start them, bigger is not always better. It's more transplant shock. But all the information you need is on the back of a quality seed packet.
So what are some of your tips for starting seeds indoors? I know that location can be pretty key.
You bet. So most seeds don't need light to germinate, but they need warmth. And so in my house, it's pretty cool. I keep it cool. So I start all my seeds in my closet. There's no light, but it's the warmest room in my house. As soon as they sprout, I get them out and I put them either in a bright sunny window, or actually I've had much better success. I use LED plant lights, much more powerful, energy efficient, and the cost has come drastically dropped. So it's an affordable option. And so as soon as you see the green, put them under light or into a sunny window. That's when they need that sunlight. Clean containers, a sterile planting mix or seed starting mix, and then quality seeds. So warmth to germinate, light once they're up and growing, keep the soil slightly moist, and then you'll need to fertilize with a very dilute solution of fertilizer every couple of weeks. Again, check the bag. It'll tell you the potting mix, oh, it's got a slow-release fertilizer. You won't need to start as quickly, or maybe, you know, as soon as those leaves are up and growing, very dilute solution of any kind of liquid houseplant fertilizer.
So about how big should they be before you start putting them in the garden?
You know, good question. So one is the weather outside. Okay, so we want to make sure it's nice and warm. I like using floating row covers. They're fabric that lets air, light, and water through but traps the heat, and they're low maintenance. I can put my plants in, cover them, anchor it, and I'm done, and leave enough slack. A lot of times I'll put clear plastic, you know, over the garden, get some of those annual weeds to sprout, lightly cultivate. I'm eliminating like half the weeds before I plant. I've warmed the soil, less shock for the plants, and then I can get those transplants in. We also want to gradually introduce them to the outdoors. You know, they've been inside under lights or a sunny window. It's nice inside, and then we put them outside. So the first day, give them maybe an hour of direct sunlight. Then the next day, two, three, four, five, so on. And stop fertilizing till you get them in the garden. And so that's a way to gradually, it's called hardening off. And that's a good way to get them used to the outdoors.
There was something that I was looking up that was called winter sowing. What is that?
You know, I learned this method when I was speaking in Fort Wayne a few years ago, and a couple of gardeners presented it. And it's a cool idea because you don't need lights, you don't need to water every day, so it's very low maintenance. Take a milk jug, drill four holes on the bottom, or a soda bottle, a 2-liter soda bottle, cut the top off so the bottom is about 4 inches deep, and then you leave the handle attached, you know, so there's just this little part attached. Fill that bottom with potting mix, you know, and you've got the drainage holes in the bottom, moisten, then plant your seeds. Now you could do your broccoli, Brussels sprouts, you could do a lot of your perennial herbs right now. Then you close it, duct tape it shut, take the cap off, and put it, I put mine on the south side of my house, but away so that they do get rain and snow. Check them if we have a dry spring. And it is amazing. You know, the first time I did it, I thought, well, if I have 50% success, I'll be happy. I had coneflowers. Chives are pretty easy, but I did chives. I even did some tomatoes. But I'm going to wait a little bit, like early April, to do my tomatoes and basil when it's warmer. But it's a great way, very low maintenance. And I think it's something that is fun to do with kids, but at gardeners of all ages, because you don't need special equipment. And, you know, I did perennials perennials, and I could divide them out, plant them out, and one packet of seeds, I got 20 plants versus one plant that could cost a little more. So you can take your plant budget and stretch it further that way.
Yeah, what is the benefit of that versus starting a seed indoors?
It's really I think it's the input you have to do. So the benefit, you know, indoors you get to touch and feel, which I think right now some of us are dying for some greenery. So there's that benefit that I have something to tend. But you also need to be there daily or have someone in your house that can check the moisture every day. You need to have good light. And sunny windows usually aren't enough. You know, our days aren't that long yet. The sun isn't that intense. So we end up with long, leggy transplants. But we get to tend them, and we get to watch them, and we get to nurture them. And outside, it's just you put them in there, you set them out, you check occasionally, make sure the soil's moist, and that's it. So from a convenience standpoint, winter sowing is great. You can do a lot without needing a lot of lighting and space, but you miss that nurturing part.
What is the danger of them getting too leggy indoors?
Good question. So we used to start our tomatoes, and I meet old-time gardeners, I might qualify for that as well, that still want to start them in the middle of March. But what we found is they were long, the stems were weak because the light intensity wasn't that great, and so it's more of a shock to the plant when we put it out. Rather, when you start with a smaller plant, it's been growing inside for a shorter period. So the transition's easier. It's usually a stockier plant, and it's less of a transplant shock going out. I ran into a woman a couple weeks ago on my speaking tour, and she goes, "So what would you tell someone who started sunflower seeds indoors 2 weeks ago?" And I went, "Was that you?" And she goes, "Yep." And I said, "Well, give them as much light as you can and, you know, see what happens."
See how it works. All right. Well, Melinda Myers, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, thank you.
Melinda Myers is a gardening expert and the author of many books on the subject, including Small Space Gardening and Midwest Gardener's Handbook. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you can find their previous conversations at WUWM.com. We'll hear from a gourmet chef turned monk living just an hour north of Milwaukee when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Even though church services have been canceled around the region, that doesn't mean the Christian calendar has stopped. Millions of Christians around the world observe Lent this time of year. The traditional 40-day period in preparation for Easter is usually marked by abstaining from certain indulgent foods and behaviors. Fish fries are popular in Milwaukee in part because of the Catholic practice of skipping meat during Lent. An hour north of Milwaukee, there's a community of Eastern Catholic monks who do really take that meatless thing seriously. Holy Resurrection Monastery in the town of St. Nazian's, Wisconsin, belongs to the Romanian Greek Catholic Church. Their faith is almost identical to the Eastern Orthodox, but they're in union with the Pope of Rome, and thus the rest of Wisconsin Catholics. Lake Effect producer Julian Haida recently visited the monastery chef, Deacon Moses, in his kitchen to talk about what it's like to cook the Orthodox way. They abstain from all animal products and even skip wine and olive oil.
Every Wednesday and Friday, we abstain from all animal products. So no meat, no fish, no eggs, no dairy, and also no wine or olive oil.
So it's like a vegan extreme.
Yes, exactly.
So what are some of the challenges that pose themselves? I mean, it's you know, veganism is something that's very popular, but it's also not cheap.
It's not cheap. I find it much easier to keep to my budget and to feed the brothers outside the fasting periods. It does take a lot more thought, a lot more looking around and shopping to be able to prepare healthy, nutritious meals that are fast friendly as well.
So how many days out of the year would you say are fasting? I mean, you said Wednesdays and Fridays, but that's during like a normal period. But year round, how often do you fast?
If you add it all up, it would come to about half the year. We have four traditional fasting periods, Lent before Easter, the fast before Christmas, which is another 40-day fast, and then the Peter and Paul fast and the Dormition fast, by the time you add that all up and all of the Wednesdays and Fridays, it comes to about half the year.
Now I want to ask you a little bit about your story. You are now feeding a group of about 10 monks, correct?
Yes.
So about 10 monks here in central Wisconsin. But before this, you were a professionally trained chef. Tell me about how you ended up here.
Oh, that's a long story.
All right. Nutshell, I mean, I believe you studied at a very well-known culinary school.
Yes, I studied at the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York, back in the early 80s. Went on to have a very good career as a chef. But I had always wanted to be a monk as well. I grew up a Roman Catholic, but my job took me to Greece for a year, where I was introduced to the Byzantine style of Catholicism and Orthodoxy, and I just fell in love with the Byzantine spirituality, the liturgy, and all of that. So eventually I changed rites, and finally when I was around 30, I decided it was time to pursue my vocation as a monk. So
how did you know you'd be able to balance your new vocation with, for lack of a better word, your old vocation, which was in the kitchen?
Well, when I decided to pursue my vocation as a monk, I really didn't think I would be able to. I thought maybe once in a while or quite a ways down the road I might be assigned to the kitchen, but I was ready to give it up if I had to pursue it. But thankfully, the abbot, unlike some other abbots, his philosophy is to put people to do the work that they're best suited for. He knew my history and put me in the kitchen.
So it worked out.
Yes, it did work out. And I think the rest of the brothers are happy about that.
And the people who visit the monastery as well. I mean, you've built a little bit of a reputation for yourself here in the Manitowoc, Sheboygan area.
A little bit. One of the ways that the monastery supports itself is through our ministry with guests. We have people come to do private retreats. We have groups that come, I think, because of what I can do in the kitchen, better cater to the pilgrims and the guests.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WWM 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm here in St. Nazaire's, Wisconsin with Abuna Moses. He is a deacon and also the chef at a monastery called Holy Resurrection Monastery. It's in the Sheboygan, Manitowoc area. What do you think the broader American public can learn from things like a fasting rule that is spiritually grounded as opposed to something like, you know, a health fad?
Okay. In reality, when we fast, we look at the three different aspects of the first being abstaining from certain foods and limiting the amount of food that we eat. The second being almsgiving. In the ancient world, when these guidelines for fasting were developed, what we eat now was just the poor man's food. Unfortunately, today, it's not the poor man's food.
So you mean like fish? You mean like...
One of the things that we're allowed any day of the year is shellfish. Today, in today's world, that's a luxury item. It's an expensive item. But back in the day, in Greece and in the Mediterranean, it was poor man's food. You went down to the shore, you collected some clams or some mussels or whatnot, and you had dinner. That was where you got your protein from. Today, you know, you can't do that. That's an arm and a leg. So although it's allowed during the fasting period, I rarely cook it because of the expense. I'll save that for a special occasion, someone's birthday, someone's feast day, that type of thing. But for the most part, we're eating, as best as I can make it, a poor man's diet. Greens, beans, pasta, rice, lots of veggies. So basically, yeah, a very a basic vegan diet.
Now I want to ask you, also a lot of people are cutting meat and they're looking for a lot of meat substitutes. Historically, we've known all about bean burgers and all this good stuff. But I mean, last year, 2-3 years, we've seen the rise of Impossible burgers and meat substitutes that are uncannily like meat. And I think some Catholic leaders have come out and said that's not quite in the spirit of fasting. So how would you navigate this kind of brave new world of not meat meat?
I really haven't delved into that much. My philosophy on it is, if it's that close of an imitation of meat, I would tend to avoid it, just because it's something we're supposed to be. Even though if it meets the letter of the law, it really, you know, to me it just doesn't feel right.
Because it's a matter of mindfulness, in your opinion.
Exactly. You're supposed to be living a poor life so that the money that we save from changing our diet can then be given as alms to the poor. They all work together. And these impossible burgers and the fake meat, to me, it's along the lines of shellfish or whatnot that, again, were allowed. But it's adding expense to the diet, which really goes against, at least in my mind, the whole overall picture.
I think, you know, when some people say they're giving something up for Lent, I think, you know, say it's chocolate, as is a frequent one, or candy, and then they break that, and they say, oh, I'm going to hell now, right, or something like that. I'm sure you've heard it, you know. I've broken the fast.
I deal with it all the time.
What kind of recommendations do you have for people who kind of fall off the horse and try to get back on? Should they just give up? Should they feel that, from in your perspective, how does that play?
I actually think that when you fall, that's a good thing, because it shows that you're trying. You fall, you get back up. You fall, you get back up. You just keep trying. You just keep. Unlike in the Western perspective, where they see that if you do break your fast, it's sinful. In the East, we've never seen it like that. The fast is there for our discipline, to help us grow closer to God, to aid in our prayer life. It's there for us. So we need to use it for our own benefit. If you do fall, no big deal. Pick yourself up, dust yourself off, get back on the wagon.
Hmm. Well, thank you for setting us up. What are we having for dinner today?
Tonight I'm going to make pasta with white beans and broccoli rabe.
All right, let's get going.
All right. A lot of people, at least I found here in Wisconsin, are not familiar with broccoli rabe. Although it's called broccoli, it's really more along the lines of in the mustard family. So it's a bit of a bitter green with little bits that look like buds that look like broccoli, although it's not broccoli. I've got three bunches here that I have just chopped up, and we're going to blanch off.
Where do you find broccoli rabe in this area?
Oh, I can't find it here in St. Nazian's or in Manitowoc. So I went down to Milwaukee yesterday, and you can find it in any of the Outback markets or Whole Foods, any of the bigger supermarkets.
Okay.
So we're going to blanch that off. It looks like a lot, but it will cook down.
Like spinach, it cooks
exactly
down.
Exactly, like any green. So I'm just putting it in the boiling water. We're going to just let it blanch off for a minute or two, and then we'll strain it back out. So that's it, just about a minute. So it's wilted and a nice, bright, vivid green. And I'm going to strain it out. But I'm going to save the water. I'm going to cook the pasta in the same water that I blanched the broccoli rabe in. We'll add some of that nice flavor to the pasta as well while it's cooking.
Is the water salted?
Yes.
How much do you salt your water when you're doing something like this?
I hate to give amounts, but it should taste like seawater. So it should be fairly heavily salted. Next step, I've got some fresh breadcrumbs that I made this morning, and we're going to toast them up with some garlic, about 5 or 6 cloves.
So then you're tossing the breadcrumbs into the oil and garlic.
And we'll let the whole thing toast up together.
So now you're tossing the pasta, and what kind of pasta did you choose?
Today I'm using arancetta, looks like little round ears. I like them because they're cupped to hold on to the oil and the garlic and the broccoli. Cannellini beans that I cooked in the Instapot this morning. Just some little bit of vegetable broth and a bay leaf, and that's about it.
Could canned beans work?
Canned beans work, yep. I find that the dried beans are a fraction of the cost, and they taste better. As far as I'm concerned, that's two good things. But yeah, canned beans are much quicker and easier. And
with a pressure pot, like an Instapot, you could do that pretty quickly, whereas probably before you probably would have had to boil that for hours and hours.
Exactly. It would have taken, a couple of hours. I throw the beans in the Instapot in the morning, put them on, go to church, and I come out of church and they're ready. All right, now I'm going to take the garlic and breadcrumbs out of the pan, but we're going to use the same pan to saute everything together. And then the breadcrumbs will be added at the end. Add a nice crunch. All right, I'm going to add a little bit more oil. Get it nice and hot.
How do you know when the oil is hot enough but not too hot?
Before it starts splattering or bubbling, at this point there's a little bit of breadcrumbs left in the pan, so I can kind of watch what they're doing to see when they're ready. And they're just starting to move around there. I'm going to throw the broccoli rabe in.
Now you're seasoning the broccoli rabe in the same pan that you had the breadcrumbs and the garlic with red pepper flakes. What else?
A little bit of black pepper, kosher salt. The broccoli rabe is sauteing. It's absorbed a good amount of that oil. I'm adding the cooked cannellini beans. I'm going to add a little bit of the cooking liquid that the pasta's cooking in, which will incorporate with everything else to make the sauce.
Now that looks pretty wet right now with the water from the pasta. Does that cook down?
It's going to cook down. When the pasta is about 3/4 of the way cooked, I'm going to add it into the, and it will continue cooking and it'll absorb what water is left.
So it's sort of like cooking rice in that way.
Exactly. A lot of people will cook pasta and pour sauce on top. I always like to cook my pasta about 3/4 of the way and finish its cooking in the sauce. Much more flavorful. The starch that's expelled from the pasta helps to thicken the sauce and bind everything together. A much more incorporated dish. Much more like you'd find in Italy than here in America.
Well, that's very interesting. I never heard that before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you grew up in an Italian-American household. How different was the kind of cooking that you did in Italy compared to that?
I grew up in an Italian-American neighborhood, and my aunts all married Italians, but I don't have any Italian blood, although it's my favorite cuisine in the world. So, although we did eat predominantly Italian food. There's much more meat in the Italian-American diet than you would find in the everyday diet in Italy. Even, the big Italian-American dish, spaghetti and meatballs, is unheard of in Italy. You would never eat pasta and meatballs together. Meatballs would be one course, pasta would be another. They might be cooked together, but they're never served together.
Makes it easy cooking vegan then.
It does make it. And most traditional pasta dishes that you'll find in Italy are vegetarian.
So what do you feel like on your teeth when you're chewing the pasta? I mean, you don't want it to kind of stick, right?
No, it shouldn't stick, but like they say, al dente, you should have to still bite it. It shouldn't be what we would say in Italian-American, mouchard. It should be mushy. It should have some texture still to it. Some people will say throw it against the wall. I'm not quite so...
What's it supposed to do when you throw it against the wall?
It should stick.
When it's cooked?
When it's cooked.
Or is that
I've
overcooked?
I've never tried that, but I have heard that, so I don't know. But this pasta should be pretty much.
So you're using like a mesh spoon to drop it from the straight from the water right into the sauce.
Yes, it leaves a little bit of the water still on, and it allows me to keep this water in case I need more for my sauce.
So if you pour it down the drain through a sieve, you'd lose the water.
Exactly. So if you are going to use a colander to strain it out, always take a couple of cups on the side in case you need it.
This is a very colorful dish, I must say.
It is, that nice, bright, vivid green, the white pasta and the beans. And
so this broccoli rabe pasta that is standing on the stove. We're going to come back to it in just a few hours after the church service is over, but it only took about 20 minutes up to here. Is this something that people can do at home?
Sure, it's very easily done at home. I'm working on a cookbook which will include this recipe as well as quite a few other vegan recipes, as well as regular recipes. The book that we're working on is Feasting and Fasting Throughout the Church Year, and we're doing it from a monk and a mom's perspective. So if you have kids and how to incorporate vegan food into their diet, it might be something you'd be interested in looking at.
And you also hosted a web series, cooking videos.
Yes. A good friend of mine, Mother Gabriella, from a Byzantine Catholic nuns monastery in Ohio, Christ the Bridegroom Monastery, worked on this project together, Eastern Hospitality, where we did a number of videos, where we talked about faith and spirituality, and we tied it together with food, and it was always a recipe that we cooked together.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
Let my prayer arise in your sight as incense, and let the lifting up of my hands be an evening sacrifice.
That was Lake Effect producer Julian Haida with Deacon Moses, a monk at the Holy Resurrection Monastery in St. Nazian's, Wisconsin. You can find his recipe for broccoli rabe pasta at wuwm.com. Coming up next, we learn about how we can practice Corona kindness. Lake Effect continues on 89.7
WUWM.
More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Scientists are still working to understand COVID-19, and there remains a lot of uncertainty about how it behaves. That uncertainty breeds fear, and that fear can bring out the worst of us. Lake Effect contributor Arno Michaelis is a former white supremacist who now makes his living traveling the world speaking out against hate and violence. His work has come to a grinding halt due to cancellations, travel bans, and practicing social distancing. But Michaela says taking the time to examine and change our behavior for the health and safety of others is crucial. One way we can do that is through what he calls Corona kindness.
I was driving up Prospect Avenue and noticed a couple with a baby walking out of the hospital trying to cross the street. They were visibly upset. My first thought was that they were upset because no one was stopping to let them cross. So I stopped, stopping a bunch of cars behind me, and they took the opportunity to cross the street. The woman snapped out of her frustration for a second, smiling at me and giving a cherished thank you wave. I can only imagine what that couple is really stressed about. I really hope all it was being unable to cross the street. It could be, and likely is, something much more stressful. I am stressed out of my gourd myself. Coronavirus is royally derailing my program. I make my living speaking to large crowds of people in public places, and my livelihood is literally being canceled left and right. Through it all, I'm massively grateful that I live with my amazing mom in a house that's paid for, and that while my family isn't loaded by any stretch, we have enough to forgo the stresses that billions of people face every day. I'm deeply mindful that the impact coronavirus has on our economy has already devastated countless people exponentially beyond the hit I'm taking. I've always been fascinated by the econo system, a marvel of interdependence that gives so many people means to not only survive, but thrive. Just trying to get my head around what the suspension of the NBA season will cost is dizzying. Opening day for the Brewers. And now the NHL too? No! Considering the domino effect of everything else being suspended is otherworldly. While there are much more lethal diseases, the contagiousness of coronavirus means that there will be many fatal cases. Thinking of all the people suffering with it and losing loved ones is horrific. We, as in everyone on this planet, are in for a rough ride as we all work to sort this pandemic out. which is why kindness is now more important than ever and more powerful than it's ever been. I don't want a cookie for letting pedestrians cross the street. Giving kindness is its own reward. I just want to share how the very simple act of kindness gave me what I needed to keep going today. And the ridiculously beautiful thing is, when I need something to keep going tomorrow, which I will, all I have to do is find someone to be kind to. And a very important point. We can totally be kind online and or otherwise from a distance. See the campaign staythehome.com. Note to self, Arno. The practice and cultivation of kindness has never been a fluffy kumbaya game. We humans evolved the ability as a survival trait, and with its comrades, compassion, forgiveness, gratitude, and wisdom, kindness has kept us going for 200,000 years. If we're going to keep going through this, we all got to triple down on our kindness practice. Our great human family is at stake. I love you all.
That was Lake Effect contributor Arno Michaelis reading his essay, Corona Kindness. You can find more of his essays and interviews with us at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers and Julian Haida join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer, and we also heard from Olivia Richardson and Chuck Kornbach this week from the WUWM news team. Lauren Sigvason is our digital producer, Jason Reevy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3. That's for Lake Effect Weekend, only here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.